It is really good to be here, and thank you. And to Dr. Georges Benjamin and the board of the APHA, thank you for pulling this together. This really is a wonderful summit, and we're very appreciative of having the opportunity to speak with you this morning. And to my many dear friends out here and colleagues, both old and new, and I look forward to meeting many of you who I haven't and get to know you a lot better. I'm truly honored to be here with Dr. Koh and my other colleagues. It's been a real joy to work with individuals like Dr. Koh who are really, really committed to the things you saw just now. And it isn't just a commitment because of the job, but it's a lifelong commitment. So it's been a real, real joy. You know, people often ask, particularly my friends, they ask, what should I call you now? Should I call you general? Should I call you surgeon? What should I call you? So I actually prefer to be called doctor, or by most of you, just Regina. But while my formal title is Surgeon General, the rank on my uniform is actually that of a three-star admiral. That's because I lead the United States Public Health Service, which was begun as a service to provide health care to the merchant marines. The uniform is modeled after the Navy as a tribute to the public health's nautical roots. The Public Health Service was created in response to a deadly outbreak of yellow fever that devastated the people of Philadelphia back in 1793, when the city was serving as our nation's temporary capital. That epidemic killed about 10% of the population and drove a third of the residents out of town. It was unknowingly brought to Philadelphia by the merchant sailors, who were a vital part of the free flow of commerce that was the lifeblood of our young country. As a result, then President John Adams signed into law a bill creating a national system of hospitals to treat merchant marines. Some of you may even remember the old public health hospitals. Today, I command 6,500 Commissioned Corps officers who administer health programs across the country and abroad. We also provide health care to people in health clinics, Indian reservations, federal penitentiaries, and many of your state and local health departments. We also have 200,000 volunteer corps called the MRC, the Medical Reserve Corps. So I'd encourage you to sign up for the Medical Reserve Corps in your state when you get back home. I tell you all of this because this is an example of what strong leadership from a president can do to address the acute needs and healthcare needs of a country. And that's what President Obama's doing with the Health Reform and Affordable Care Act. I'm sitting here now kind of out of breath. I realize, why is that? Because I'm in Denver. But I realize I was in Denver. So I'd like to start by just kind of sharing with you how I got involved in community and why I stay involved. Many of my friends have heard this, so kind of bear with me. But when I was an intern, I attended the Medical Association of Georgia's annual meeting. And one of the intense issues that was being debated was that sexually transmitted diseases needed to be taught in medical school. Well, I stood up in a room with maybe 20, 25 people, and I told them I'd never seen syphilis, gonorrhea, or certain diseases except in a textbook, and I thought there was a need. Well, the resolution passed, and the Georgia delegation sent the resolution, forwarded it to the AMA. And the Georgia delegation also sent me to the AMA to speak to the same issue, and it passed. And within 6 months, every medical school in this country was encouraged to include sexually transmitted diseases as part of their core curriculum. I learned that one person can make a difference, whether it's in medical policy or in medical practice. And I learned that I could make a difference in medical practice when the National Health Service Corps sent me to Bayou La Batre. It's a pretty place, but it's a poor place. I found a community of working poor. Too poor to afford medical care, but too rich to qualify for Medicaid. I like the people, I like the community, and I wanted to practice medicine there. But practicing medicine wasn't just sewing up the shark bites. I had to deal with the land sharks, the regulators, the reviewers, the red tape dispensers, and all that paperwork and things that go on with it. So I decided to stay involved with the community in any organization I could to get services to our community. I learned that my patients had problems, that my prescription pad by itself wouldn't take care of and wouldn't solve. Things like adequate housing, especially after Katrina, employment opportunities, clean water, all kinds of problems. And so I stayed involved with the Chamber of Commerce, the Red Cross, the various organizations within the community to get services. I found patients who, I love to talk about my patients, but I had patients who couldn't read at the age of 26. Patients who couldn't understand their medications and get them confused. So we had to bring adult literacy to the community. Even before we could talk about health literacy, we had to get them to read basic English. One patient I do want to tell you about, though, is Mrs. Smith. Mrs. Smith is 40-something-year-old, African-American woman, about that high, about that tall. And she called me on a weekend. Patients can call me and they don't abuse it, but she called me on a weekend and she says, "Dr. Benjamin, my back is really, really hurting. And that ibuprofen that you gave me is not strong enough, it's not helping." She says, "You know that surgeon you sent me to, he told me I need to lose some weight. And I've been trying, I really have, I promise, but can you call me in something stronger?" And she has what we call a slip disc or a ruptured disc. And I could hear the pain in her voice. So I said, "Sure, I can call you in something stronger, but this is Saturday. You need to come and see me on Monday or Tuesday." And sure enough, on Tuesday, I walk in the exam room, and there she is standing over the exam room in so much pain she can't sit down. And I said, "Mrs. Smith, did you get the medicine? Did the medicine help that I gave you? Did it help at all?" She says, "Well, Dr. Benjamin, I didn't get it." I said, "What do you mean you didn't get it?" She says, "Well, I couldn't afford it." I said, "What do you mean? You work at the elementary school." She works in the janitorial department. I said, "You work at the elementary school. You have Blue Cross. What do you mean that you couldn't afford it?" She says, "Well, I didn't have the copay. But I get paid Friday, and I promise you I'll get it on Friday." So I walk out of the room and get my nurse, Nell, to go across the street and get Jim, our pharmacist, to get her medicine for her. And I walk back in the room, and I have her medicine. I give her her medicine and tell her, "You're obviously in a lot of pain. You really need to start taking your medicine. And, because I can see you're hurting." And at that point, her eyes welled up with water. She says, "Oh, Dr. Benjamin, I'm so embarrassed. I didn't want you to do that." And I realized at that moment, I had taken her dignity from her. And also realized at that moment that that when you talk to someone, their dignity is so important, but that you talk about the competency, and cultural competency has nothing to do with the color of your skin. It has to do with how you treat that person and let them keep their dignity. So then I had to figure out how to get out of it, and I didn't know what to do. So I basically told her, "Ms. Smith, we have people who donate small pots of money, especially after the storms, that we can help people just like this. And you can pay it back on Friday if you want to, but you don't have to. But that's what we have those small donations for." And she was okay with that. So then as I was walking, leaving the room, she said what most of the clinicians here will understand, "Oh, by the way." She says, "Oh, by the way, can I get a work excuse?" I said, "Sure. Today's Tuesday. Start taking your medicine. Do you want to go back on Thursday? You want to go back on Friday?" She says, "Oh, no. I have to go back tonight. We've got to strip those floors." Here is a woman who cannot sit down because of pain, but she's willing to go and strip the wax off the floor so our elementary kids can go to school in a clean place. It's people like her that we advocate for. It's people like her that we want to get to be able to pay their copays, not have to pay copays. We also, people like her was the reason that I decided to leave my practice in Biola Battery after 23 years and go to Washington. And to be her voice, to work for her. And so the way I compensate with myself, I tell myself, well, you know, I left BioLabatry, but now I've opened an office in BioLabatry, and I have 300 million Americans as my new patients. And as America's doctor, I really want to provide Americans with the best scientific information available on how to live healthier lives. I'm also trying to bring some clarity and understanding to that overwhelmingly confusing conversations about health and healthcare. I really am especially grateful to serve at this historic time as we make overdue changes in how we finance and how we deliver healthcare, changes that will eventually give all Americans access to high-quality, affordable healthcare that they deserve. But giving Americans health coverage is just the first step to truly reducing the health disparities that plague our country. But we know that reducing and ultimately eliminating health disparities will require more than just giving Americans an insurance card. We have to address those social determinants of health, such as poverty. A study published in the December issue of the American Journal of Public Health showed that poverty and dropout rates are at least as important a health problem as smoking is in the United States. And we know how bad smoking is. On average, poverty showed the greatest impact on health. Smoking was second, followed by being a high school dropout, non-Hispanic Black, obese, a binge drinker, and uninsured. The second step is one that's just as challenging, and that's prevention. Prevention is the foundation of our nation's public health system, and prevention is the foundation of my work as Surgeon General. And my priorities as Surgeon General focus on prevention and wellness. And I'll just name a couple of those. And basically, obesity, my first paper was the Surgeon General's vision for a healthy and fit nation, and trying to address the issue of obesity, and I've been working with the First Lady on the Let's Move campaign. We have a breastfeeding report coming out soon because we know that a child that is exclusively breastfed for the first 6 months of life is less likely to be obese. HIV/AIDS, particularly in women and girls, is still a major, major issue. Mental health and substance abuse. I spent this summer and still working with the Gulf oil spill and the behavioral effects along the Gulf Coast. Violence is a major problem in this country. It's at a public health level and has been for a while, particularly with youth violence, gender violence, domestic violence, workplace, and random violence. And of course, in all of this, we need to eliminate health disparities. But let me take a couple of minutes now to just talk about the specifics of the affordable health care and health reform that relate to prevention. As Dr. Cole told you, there was a number of changes that went into effect on September 23rd. A couple of them, one particularly, is that under the, and he mentioned it to you, that under the new law, health plans have to cover preventive services, such as mammograms, colonoscopies, immunizations, flu shots, diabetes, hypertension, prostate screening, and well care. And also under the new law, they cannot charge a copay or deductible for these services. And so I was really pleased with that, particularly after Mrs. Smith's story that I told you. But the most one that I'm involved with is that the Affordable Care Act provides a historic funding commitment to promote prevention and wellness. This new law established the National Prevention, Health Promotion, and Public Health Council, which I have the honor to chair. The members of this council is made up of high-level and people in government. They're cabinet-level heads of agencies throughout government, not just with HHS. That really signifies the importance of this council. And I have to tell you that they really are engaged and they attend the meetings themselves, which is unheard of in Washington. This council will provide coordination and leadership at the federal level to ensure that government is focused on prevention. We're going to develop the first ever national prevention strategy, and as you've seen, we have $15 billion prevention fund that everybody's paying attention to. We're going to make recommendations to the president and to Congress about the most pressing health issues affecting the nation and changes in federal policy to help prevent them. We sent our first status report to the president this summer, and the president's going to soon be announcing a public advisory group to the council. With this council, I hope to move us from a system of sick care to a system of wellness and prevention. And as a family physician, I, like many of you, have seen so many missed opportunities that prevention in health care settings has had across this nation. If we truly want to reform our health care system in this country, we need to prevent people from getting sick in the first place. We need to stop the illness and stop the disease before it starts. So in addition to the state-of-the-art medicine that we have, we need a new approach to promoting prevention in our communities. Since staying healthy depends on other factors that influence our health, like housing, transportation, education, the availability of quality, affordable food, our workplaces, and our environments. I want to change the way we think about health in this country, and that calls for the nation to take a more holistic approach to community health, everything from safe highways and work site wellness programs to clean air and healthy foods. You know, working with this council so far has given us an opportunity to bring federal agencies to the table so that they're coming to understand that their business is about health and community's health. We want to get them to a place where everyone understands that almost everything they do, even though it's not labeled as health or prevention, really does affect health. It affects quality and the length of all Americans' lives. So one of the biggest challenges that I've come across so far is to get those of us in medicine and those of us in public health to start to embrace this idea. Because we really are so involved, and should be, in our everyday work, in our everyday world of disease and illness. It's really hard sometimes for us to think beyond the current life and death situation. However, if we think about the fact that the determinants of a long and healthy life, we know that what the healthcare system and the public health does is only one part of that and one factor. There are other things like income, education, good housing, racial and ethnic and ethnicity, sexual orientation, and all the associated experiences or stigma that go along with that. Our physical environment, things from clean air to water to the built environment. And a host of other factors also have a major effect on the way our health outcomes are. I really want to use this national prevention strategy to reshape how we think about health and prevention in the government and throughout the nation. In fact, Melanie Barnes recently expressed the White House's commitment to this by saying, quote, "We're putting our focus in the White House on people and places in a way we believe strengthens neighborhoods and improves health outcomes. We're using a multidisciplinary approach and strategy because, after all, every aspect of life includes health. It includes education, it includes housing and energy and transportation. People don't wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to have an education day today, and tomorrow I'm going to have a transportation day. For families, all of these pieces are integrated, so we have to start thinking about our policies and our approach in that same way. So it's been really good to have the support of the entire administration, which gives us a great opportunity. And so as chair, I really need your help and your guidance. And that's why we're trying to get as much input from our stakeholders as possible. One of our stakeholders suggested that our council make our vision that the current generation of children should lead longer, healthier lives than their parents. And I thought that was a pretty good idea. In fact, the OECD data ranks the United States last among comparable developed countries for life expectancy at birth, and second to last for life expectancy at age 65. So I'm going to be asking the council to agree that the national prevention strategy should be set as a national goal that the United States rank first in the world for life expectancy at birth and at age 65. So again, I'm going to really need your help, and not only in developing the national prevention strategy, but also as we start to implement it. This really is an exciting time to be in healthcare. We have an opportunity to make our health system work better and easier for our patients and the people we serve. And so I'm going to stop here and have you come up and ask questions and give your comments, and then I'll finish with some closing comments.
I have a question.
Sure.
while you're getting up to the microphone, my question is, Surgeon General, is that the World Health Organization has established its Commission on the Social Determinants of Health. And it was really delightful to hear a Surgeon General talk about the root causes of ill health and health inequity in this country. And I applaud you for that. And we're deeply appreciative of your leadership in that regard. The Commission essentially sets three goals. The first is to improve the conditions of daily life in communities where people work, play, pray, and live. And that's really a focus on place, on neighborhood. The second is really to tackle the inequitable distribution of resources, income, wealth, opportunity. And the third is to measure the problem and to provide some leadership in creating a workforce that understands the social determinants of health. So the World Health Organization has put forward this template, really, for nations to adopt strategies to eliminate health inequity in a generation. And the U.S. has sort of been kind of quiet on this challenge, and I'm wondering where you stand on that.
Well, I think it's a very worthy goal to achieve and be a part of. I actually attended the World Health Assembly and spoke to the non-communicable diseases portion of that. And we are, as a country, very supportive. And how could you not be? I mean, it's just obvious that we are. And we, as a council, though, have not taken that into consideration. So that's a great idea. We're taking into the consideration the different parts of it, but as a whole, we haven't discussed it, how we can bring it into the council, but I think that would be a good idea. But we certainly support it, and certainly support. When I talk about the non-communicable disease portion, it's basically was talking about the obesity and the overweight issues around not just the United States, but around the world. Great.
Mark.
Thank you very much. Mark Horton, State Health Officer in California. Dr. Benjamin, thank you very much, and I really appreciate your comments today, and I respect very much the role that you have in sharing this new council moving forward and the opportunities of really injecting a health and all policies approach to defining our public health strategy. My question is specifically regarding what we can expect in the new national prevention strategy. I'm wondering that before we choose the specific health domains that we need to address in the strategy, like tobacco, obesity, alcohol and substance abuse, can we expect to see in the national strategy a step back and a rearticulation of what our national strategy should be in addressing those specific areas, so that will we see charges to the various cabinets that are that you're pulling together in the council, specific charges to them on how they need to address health going forward. We'll be able to see a rearticulation of what the role of the core governmental public health entities at the federal, state, and local level is in advancing health initiatives, the role of the healthcare industry, both private and public, the role of the critical networks of community-based organizations and non-governmental entities. Will we see a more broad articulation of what our strategy needs to be moving forward in addressing those issues. Thank you.
Yes, and you've articulated them very well, so I won't repeat them. But we're having a town hall meeting here on Sunday that hopefully you'll join and give some of those comments to, for that very reason, because we want to be able to make sure we get your input and make sure we're going in the right direction. And as it is right now, we have 10 areas that's as a template that we have, and only one of those is for the medical illnesses and the diseases that you're talking about. The others are for all those other things, the outside group, the for HUD to build homes that are conducive to improved lifestyle. For example, we know that in a geriatric population or elderly community, people tend to live longer if they live in a street that has porches, front porches, and things like that. That's the science is there to back it up. So there are different areas that we're doing, but those disease specific is only under one little area. All the rest of them are more. And it would be great if all of you would come to the town hall meeting, because these are not in stone yet. We're still developing. I will say that we hope to have a document of some sort for you to start to comment on by the end of this month, early December. So what you say right now really makes a big difference. So I encourage you to come. Thanks.
Let's go over there.
Good morning. Susan Forster, also from the California Department of Public Health. I have a question very much related, and that is with other parts of the federal government, and particularly USDA. The program that I work is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, and we've been working to apply a public health approach to what they call nutrition education. And yet, over the years, particularly during the last administration, things like physical activity, food security, policy systems, and environmental change really have been stripped out of our ability to work on this program when we're in the very lowest income communities and with the most disparate families with children. And so I'm wondering, we've been trying to get public health approaches written into that program for quite a long time, and I'm hoping that you might be able to say how much longer that missed opportunity is going to remain elusive.
Well, we have the meetings with the secretaries and the heads of the departments, but then we have a group called the designees that meet, which is their deputies and some others, and having them there talking to each other, you're seeing these conversations start to happen, and that didn't happen before because they're in the room talking about some of the same things. And just having that part, if we didn't go any further, we've accomplished a lot just having them do that. We didn't know what each other was doing. Many of the other agencies outside of HHS have a number of projects and programs going that really affect health. So just that part is a step forward. And as we move, I can't give you a date as to when it would be better, but our hope is that those leaders, the secretaries, the cabinet level members, when they say they're involved in this and they're engaged, their entire agency becomes engaged and everything starts to flow from there. And I've seen that happen just after one meeting with them. So having those deputies go back and make it part of their entire department will make it easier when you submit these ideas and when people submit grants to say, we want the health portion, we want the public health part in there. So I guess the term would be health in all policies is what we're going after.
Just make a quick announcement.
Sure.
Just an update on the town hall that the Surgeon General is referring to. It's actually on Monday at the Convention Center in room 203 from 7:30 to 9:30. So that's Monday. We'll go over here.
Early in the morning. Yes.
My name is Gil O'Hanlon, and I run a think tank, state decision makers in California for the University of California called CPAC. And my question relates to the role of the Surgeon General in often being a bully pulpit for important issues related to the public. And one of the concerns that a lot of us have is that certain sectors of the healthcare industry been fully pulling the full court press to continue to oppose the implementation of health care reform. Even to the point of letters that go off from insurance companies saying, well, we're going to raise our rates and we're going to do this and this and that because of the health care reform act. And there's a number of provisions that they're responsible for implementing, some of which had the with implementation date of September 23rd. So how does the Surgeon General and other key officials in the administration respond by using their bully pulpit to address some of these actions by the industry, particularly the sectors of the industry that continue to oppose the implementation of healthcare reform?
Great question. We've been working really hard to try to do that. From the standpoint of the Surgeon General, my position is that we have to make sure we try to advance the evidence-based, science-based evidence. Before the health reform bill was passed, I didn't speak about it because it wasn't a law, because we don't get involved in one side or another, because I represent all patients and all of Americans, so both sides. But once that law passed, there are certain things in it that really, we have the science to back it up. We have the proof that they work, that they will get better. So we've been out there on the road trying to explain these. I hear you loud and clear that we need to do a better job, and hopefully one of the other questioners earlier for Dr. Koh was trying to get out something that's much clearer and much simpler for people to understand. So we'll be working on that.
Over that side.
Good morning. Kathleen Young, Cal State University, Northridge, Los Angeles area. First of all, Dr. Benjamin, this is the second time I've had the opportunity to hear you speak, and I want to first personally and professionally thank you for bringing care back into healthcare.
Thank you.
As well as the dignified panelists that we will continue to hear from this afternoon. My question is very simplistic. As an academic and researcher, can we please get some type of fact sheet, template, script? Because the opposition clearly has a comprehensive plan. And as someone that educates undergraduate, graduate level students, I am trying to learn the system, but as we send our students out into the world in the different facets, could we please get some type of a universal script, template, whatever you want to call it, as soon as possible? And again, thank you for this wonderful opportunity today.
Thank you. In fact, we have our staff over there writing the same thing down to say, we need to get something right away, right now, immediately. I will tell you, as I go and talk to groups, trying to give them too much information at one time is confusing. So if you can, we'll try to get everything to you, but give people enough about whatever they're interested in. If they're interested in the prevention part, give them enough about prevention, but don't go start talking about insurance. I mean, different things, because we've made it so complicated because we've tried to tell everything. Dr. Koh did a wonderful job this morning, but it took an hour. And most people don't have that long of an attention span. So if we can give them as much about what they're interested in, because everyone has their own personal part, and healthcare is personal. And once you know what their personal interest is, they tend to come on board. And if you look at some of the surveys, they don't like, the whole healthcare reform. But when you talk about individual parts, they like those individual parts that relate to them. But thank you, we will certainly do that.
Good morning, Drury Westerman, I'm a family nurse practitioner. You touched briefly on the importance of health literacy and also shared your experience of, as an intern, I believe, trying to get
family doctor.
Transmitted infections recognized as part of a health curriculum for medical students. And as a student at Columbia in New York City, my fellow students and I did research in the public schools in Southern Manhattan and discovered that our high school students knew practically nothing about sexual health, about their bodies, and they were sexually active, but there was really a total lack through our research across the nation of any type of health literacy and it's affecting our schools. And so I was wondering if you could briefly just touch on how the current administration is going to provide a leadership role of prevention and health education and literacy in our schools, and how this money and how this legislation is going to do a lot of what you're talking about, not just sexual health, but all types of health literacy in action in the school systems, and some of this money can be used to put science into our schools and take action.
Thank you. One of the things we've done this summer, particularly, I guess, over the spring and the summer, in dealing with the overweight and obesity issue and the Less Move campaign, been working with Secretary Duncan, and one of the things is that we don't have PE in school anymore in their curriculums. And he's supportive of bringing physical education back to the curriculum. And, as well as recess, because unstructured play is as important as that. But the reason I say about physical education, because most of the time, health was taught in physical ed. It was health and physical education. And when you took the physical education out, you took the health out. Some people would get science, but they didn't get health. And so when we put PE back, we put health and PE back. And he's very much has been pushing that a lot, and hopefully we'll see it very soon that it starts to come back, that we really need health back in our schools.
Over there.
Hi, my name is Andrea Abbott, and I'm a nursing professor from Iowa. And a couple things quickly. I know you're talking mostly about prevention. I know we have about 100 issues that we want to cover here, but one of them that I am concerned about is mental health. I've taken care of severely mentally ill clients in the community. And when we talk about, you talked about poverty as one of the leading causes of health disparities, certainly severely mentally ill are in that category. And I've taken care of those same patients when they're discharged from the hospital and given a prescription for a $700 medication and they don't have insurance to pay for it. Are we gonna, in the prevention category, maybe secondary prevention, is there anything we're working on to help the mentally ill, severely mentally ill in the community, get medications and get community care to keep them out of the hospitals and out of our prison systems? That's all, thanks.
Thank you. Well, I got you. Actually, that's one of my priorities. The Surgeon General's, there are a couple of Surgeon General's reports, but Dr. Satcher had one on mental health, trying to get mental health parity in the insurances, and we finally got that through. But you're right, that's something people don't want to talk about, but it's so real and it's so important that we have to keep it on the radar, particularly for the severely mentally ill, but also for those other behavioral health issues. I just did a PSA about the, we have a hotline or call-in line for the behavioral effects of the Gulf oil spill. You know, everyone will come up, you know, because I'm from the Gulf, they'll say, well, how are things in the Gulf? You know, what was the worst illnesses or what did you see? And it was behavioral health. In my town, for example, it was everything from mild depression to serious. One of my patients told me that, you know, Dr. Benjamin, I went to do my, she says, I went to go make my gumbo, as she puts it. I went to make my gumbo and I realized I didn't have the things to put in it. And I just sat at the table and cried. Whereas another patient who was a boat captain of a charter boat took his boat out and shot himself and killed himself. So behavioral health effects are very serious. Everything, it affects all of us. It can affect an entire community. So everything from the minor to the very serious, we have to make sure it stays, and it's certainly going to stay in our prevention.
Dr. Benjamin, thank you so much for being our Surgeon General. My
thank
name
you.
Is Michelle. I attend the University of Baltimore School of Public Affairs.
Great.
My question is very philosophical, and here's my question to you. How can we get the poorest of the poor involved in healthier lifestyles? What can we really do to, I know the push to Healthy People 2020 is going back into our community, and I think that's very noble, but what kind of strategies can we design as a nation to get the poorest of the poor involved in their own healthcare
Michigan? You know, it's going to take all of us to do this. I mean, this is not something we can do individually. We're going to need all the organizations, all the public-private partnerships. The one thing I kind of talk about when we look at prevention, you're not going to get venture capitalists to start investing in prevention. It's going to have to come from the government and the private nonprofit organizations to start to show that prevention really works. Once it does, then you'll get those companies to start investing in what's available then, but they have to see it first. And to do that, we're going to have to engage individuals, particularly people, individuals get this. They don't want to get sick. They don't want their kids to get sick. So this may be one of the things that we really need to start from the bottom up. What government can do is we can make it easier for people to do the healthy things, to live the healthier lifestyles. We can build the safe parks, the sidewalks that are there for people to walk. We can provide that infrastructure that those of us in public health know that you take for granted infrastructure, but you need the infrastructure to get things going. So we really need to start providing more of those infrastructures to help people be healthier and be fit. So, thanks.
Thank you very much. I'm Bill Brannan from the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, and I teach in the gerontology program. On the theme of too much information can be paralytic, and I would add, and if it's the wrong information or misses the point, it's even worse.
That's true.
As I'm sure you know, CMS and about 1,000 competing for-profit insurance companies deluge elderly people with lots of plans that seem to be devoted entirely with how to sign up for your Medicare benefits. And in those pamphlets, including about 125-page pamphlet sent yearly by CMS, there's virtually nothing said about prevention. I was shocked when I looked at the 2010 Healthy People to find out how low vaccination rates outside of the flu, which isn't that good, but things like pneumonia, how low they were when I personally tried to get vaccinated for protection against shingles. There are lots of vaccine preventive measures that older Americans need to have. No mention of that is made. So let me throw out a couple ideas and see if you can happen to put into this council. One is, just as children using the law in the school are moderately well vaccinated, maybe not like European countries, but still we do okay, why not have an adult Medicare vaccination card sent to every person on Medicare, urge them to keep up with their own vaccinations, send it to their primary care physicians. You talked about only nonprofits and government funding this. Why not make it the CMS must share its mailing list for Medicare in order to send out 1,000 advertisements for signing up for their plans. Why not make it a condition that they would either donate towards CMS paying for this kind of a card and publicity, or include it in their own publications, and see if we can do something about making older Americans, including many who are very well educated, but whose primary care providers not make them aware of the possible benefits of prevention, and especially of the available vaccines that we're going to be increasing. Most older Americans just don't know about that. Thank you.
Thank you. Those are great ideas, and I'm sure my staff is quickly writing.
Okay, let's go over here.
Thank you, Dr. Bailey, for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Attorney Bruce Burry from the Burry Law Firm, Jackson, Mississippi. I'm a DRPA student in Jackson State University. And all of us here understand we have great needs in the United States, but as we all may know, Mississippi seems to be the most needy, and also seem to have the most condensed population of persons in all the needs, especially in the Mississippi Delta. And I just wanted to ask, is there going to be anything from top down, or if there's going to be any avenues from the bottom for someone to come up to help address the needs in this
Well, as you may not know, but my clinic is 18 miles from Mississippi. So we, and the rural health is one of my areas of always making sure that rural health is understood and it's at the table, that people don't forget that there are people outside of the cities on the coast from New York and California, but that there are other people in between. So rural health is certainly on the top of our, not on the top, but it's never forgotten that we make sure that we understand. The things in the, luckily in Mississippi and in Alabama, this is probably not politically correct, so I won't say it, but anyway, we have probably the second with numbers, some of the numbers that's there. But it's easy to reach people. It's much easier to reach people in a rural community than it is sometime in a city, because everybody knows everybody. And so when you have opportunities to do things in rural settings that you don't in others, and we need to start taking advantage of some of that. But yes.
I'm just going to take the three questioners that were standing before the start of this question. I'm sorry, for time reasons. So we're going to go here, there, and then back there, and that'll be it.
Okay, and then I'll close it out with Mom.
Hello, Dr. Benjamin. I first want to show my appreciation that we have a Surgeon General that's still connected to providing direct primary care. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
My name is Renee Carter, and I'm a general internist in the Maryland and also Virginia area. And my question to you, I go to a lot of my medical society meetings, and we talk to the primary care doctors of what they see as far as the Affordable Health Care Act, and also what they see as providing care to their patients. How can we create more of a partnership for public health initiatives and also preventive care, and show the primary care doctors that we're all in the same boat, that we're all trying to provide the same sort of services to patients and the population as a whole?
I promise I didn't plant her there to ask that question. I've been very active in organized medicine through the years, serving on AMA board and things. And there was a project that we had at AMA for years, and that was called Medicine and Public Health, bringing medicine and public health closer. And it kind of fizzled, and we're trying to bring that back, because I think it's real important that medicine and public health kind of merge more, and we need to work together more to make sure that, the physicians and the nurses and the dentists, and they're right there with the patients every day, that helping them understand how important it is that they become a part of the community and become a part of those patients' lives, that we really need to make that one of our goals, that that the healthcare community, the clinicians, have a real major role to play, because they're often very strong leaders in their communities. They sit in the doctor's lounge and complain and whine and talk, and they talk to each other. And so that's an opportunity for us, I think, to bring them together a lot more. So, actually, I'm going to the AMA meeting from here, so I'll mention that again.
Yes, good morning. My name is Daniel Ali-Troutman from a local health office in someplace, Louisville, and now I'm going to USF. I'm also an executive coordinator and the community HB 2020 Citizen Advisory Committee. I have a specific question and a general comment. What in the healthcare reform bill specifically focuses on improving the infrastructure of local public health and state public health, including issues of loan forgiveness for DRPA students, MPA students, accreditation, certification, et cetera?
Great.
That's the specific question. The general comment, the theme of our conference is social justice. I think we still have a crisis of a common terminology. We've heard even this morning, decreasing health disparities, eliminating health disparities, social justice, health equity. We still have a problem in determining exactly what we're talking about, I believe. And we've not yet heard a conversation focusing on health as a basic human right, which really drives the entire philosophical direction of the human
right.
Yeah. That's my specific question and my general comment. I know it's going to be tough to convince the Secretary of Agriculture and the Secretary of Labor that I need to get on board and recognize health as a human right, but that's the way we have to go. So I wish you
the best
of luck in being able to move that agenda to the cabinet. But those are my two points.
Actually, thank you for that. we don't really have anything as specific as with the students, but I will tell you that there is a specific language that says we need to strengthen our infrastructure at the local public health. And that didn't come from HHS. We knew that. We all wanted to express the fact that we need to improve our public health infrastructure, but we didn't want to be overbearing. So as the very first meeting was going on, someone from a different agency outside of health completely brought that up. In fact, saying that we need to strengthen our public health infrastructure, particularly when we talk about vulnerabilities for not just diseases, but for preparedness and infrastructure for any kind of disasters, man-made or others, that it needed to be. So they got it. They brought it to us. We certainly endorsed it. So if you look on the 10 strategies or goals or whatever, it's one of those.
And, thank you very much.
Great. Last question.
Dr.
Last question.
Benjamin, thank you for being here and thank you for your leadership. I'm Carol Woltrey. I direct the Center for Health Leadership Practice at the Public Health Institute. I'm affiliated with the National Public Health Leadership Institute as well as the California Hawaii Regional Leadership Institute. My comment is about finding common ground and encouraging collaboration. We've had a lot of discussion about the what and the vision, and I think piggybacking on Dr. Mark Horton's statement about getting a robust platform for action. Yeah. What are you doing at the council level to really have some serious conversation about how federal agencies are going to be working together, as well as how we can begin to bring public health, primary care, and behavioral health together at the local level?
As we're starting to do this strategy, we're actually putting it together. The conversations are going along, finding out where, you know, when you get down to the details, which box you want to put it in. We're trying to figure out how to cross those things and not have to put everything in a box, because we need to start working together to do exactly what you're saying. And if you're going to be here Monday morning, I would love to you if you would bring that to the town hall group as well. We'll give it to them. But we really need to be doing that exactly, not only for those agencies, but for others as well. Thank you. You. Okay. You want the last one, or that's it?
Your closing comments.
Okay. Sorry. He says I gotta go. So, as America's doctor, I have to be able to tell you that you need to take time for yourselves. That you need to be taking good care of yourselves. So, you know, exercise, eat well, you know, enjoy yourselves. Even being here at this conference, getting to see old friends is good mental health for you. When I was on an airplane coming here last night, you know, the stewardesses said, we'll give you the little safety spiel, and it says, put your own face mask on before attempting to help others. You need to make sure you put your own face mask on. And as such, this is flu season, make sure you get your flu shot. So. And so I know, you know, things can get discouraging sometimes, but I think we're at a place where we have the best of opportunity that we've ever had, ever, as far as prevention goes. So I'm actually really encouraged by it. I like a good fight. This, I don't really think will be a fight. I think it's going to be just having people understand, and we can truly make a difference. So I want to end with a short little story about a young girl who was running up and down the beach doing her jog early in the morning. And as she was jogging, there was an older man who was tossing these starfish in the water. And as she ran, she'd see him toss these starfish, and she just couldn't understand why he was bothering. So when she finished her run, she couldn't take it anymore, so she went up to him and she says, "Why are you bothering to toss those starfish in the water? One at a time. There are hundreds and hundreds of starfish along the beach. As soon as the sun comes up, it's going to burn them off, and they're going to die anyway, and it's not going to make a difference. Why do you bother?" So he looked at her, reached down, picked up a starfish and said, because it'll make a difference to this starfish. And he tossed it in the water. As we go along, continue to find your own starfish and continue to make a difference. Thank you so much.